This week, the Working Tools podcast is on the road at the Conference of Grandmasters of North America, being held right here in Seattle, Washington. So our format's a little different. We're going to have a series of short interviews with the attendees. We hope you enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, brethren all, welcome to the Working Tools podcast, a casual conversation around Freemasonry. First, it's important to note that our thoughts and opinions are our own and do not reflect those of our Grand Lodge or respective craft or concordant bodies. Please connect with us and ask questions via our website at theworkingtoolspodcast.com.
Continuing our series of interviews here at the Conference of Grandmasters at Seattle, we have, well, I keep doing this, I keep saying, I'm going to say their names.
I'm introducing not.
David keeps telling me I should have you introduce yourself, so please introduce yourself, sir.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chris Rooley. Let's keep it in. Chris Rooley, past Grand Historian Librarian of the Grand Lodge of the District of Columbia, and just happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. So, Chris has written a book, which...
Should I say I'm an author, too? No, a writer, perhaps?
Put it in the camera window.
Chris has written a book?
Oh, this is a televised...
Well, sort
of. It's an audio recorded.
There is audio and video.
Audio, video. Cool, right on.
Which is called The White House and the Freemasons.
Yeah.
And we were just saying the Tall Cedars of Lebanon are at the conference.
Yes.
Of Grandmasters, and we've been... Several people have commented on me about their headwear, and there's a picture in your book of Warren G. Harding.
That's right. I had to go to the Library of Congress personally to pull this photograph because it was not developed, and I paid my $35 to get this photograph of Warren G. Harding and a couple. There are two other people in that photograph, or three other people in that photograph. One of them is his executive secretary, and then two others were tall cedars who were visiting. So
you, there was raw, undeveloped.
Yes. So the purpose of this book was to help explain to Masons that the study of Freemasonry or presidential history related to Freemasonry is extremely nascent. In other words, you'd think that the topic has been covered. You'd think over 200 years, people have been written this. You've been writing and talking about it and disseminating. Well, what I found was about 40% of the topics that were covered in my book, 40% of the resources, 40% of the stories, right, never covered a Masonic proceeding. In a journal, in a proceeding, in a periodical, I found it through diaries, I found it through newspapers, I found it through even an audio tape. There wasn't actually one audio tape from President Johnson back in, not Andrew Johnson, but the other Johnson, Lyndon B. Johnson. That should probably be more specific. So there's a lot of information. I started this book about 5 years ago, working on this book about 5 years ago. Back then, I didn't know it was a book. I thought it was just going to be a very nice and long paper. But over time, as by virtue of the fact that I live in D.C., I work in D.C., I get questions from past grandmasters, sometimes conferences come by and they say, hey, Chris, we're doing an event, a commemoration of a cornerstone laying, let's say. Did the President of the United States ever participate, or who was there that was, a dignitary? And so I started to collect those interactions, dinners, initiations, cornerstone ceremonies, all these things. Well, over time, that list started to grow. And then I'd find more interactions in newspapers. I'd find interactions in diaries. I'd find them in letters of correspondence from people who are just, maybe the wife of a Freemason who attended an event.
Oh, wow.
Stuff like that. I also, as a function of what happened for the last two or three years with COVID, it actually pushed the digitization. There was a lot of digitization efforts happening in presidential libraries. So I went to as many presidential libraries as I could. I dug through their archives, their virtual archives, their online archives, and their in-person archives to pull letters of correspondence, documents, invitations from lodges to have Masons come in. There's a great one online from Thomas Jefferson from a Mason in Pennsylvania saying, I'm interested in federal employment. He was a jeweler, and here is an example of my work, a Masonic jewel. He presented that to Thomas Jefferson. Now, we don't know if Jefferson sent it back. We assume he did. We don't know what the jewel looks like, but there's a record of his correspondence. Now, Thomas Jefferson was not a Mason, but you find these kinds of things in all these records. So I'm not even sure what your question was, but that's the impetus. That's the impetus for my book, finding all these stories that never existed. So we collected about 450-plus events in D.C., in Washington, D.C. alone, with presidents and the Freemasons. Pretty cool. Not just presidents, by the way. Vice presidents, first ladies, secretaries, congressmen, senators, stuff like that.
I will say you're, right off the bat, you're a much nicer person than I am, because I would have told those people who were asking you about what happened at the last cornerstone laying, I would have said, don't you have Google? Figure it out.
Yes, and the problem with Google, by the way, 30 to 40% of the stuff you see online is incorrect. Dates are wrong. Dates are mixed up and switched around with different people. Some are just outright lies. They actually put on things that are not correct, not a shock. That there's myths.
On the internet?
There's myths about it. So yeah. So some of that stuff that why I was able to find, a part of it was actually confirming that things were not right, and then going out of my way to find, okay, well, if that's not true, then how do we find the real answers? How do we find those, you know, dates that are actually accurate? There are several Masonic books out there on presidents, Freemasons in the last 100 years with conflicting information. But if you just went to your Masonic library and picked up that book and thought, well, someone's written it, it must be true, turns out it's not.
So talking about your extensive research, I went and looked. 35 pages of endnotes in here.
A bibliography worth, that's right. That's right. A bibliography worthwhile for a researcher.
So how are you able to validate that your information was more accurate than something else you read or found?
Well, there are three parts of my book. The first part is a narrative. I tell the full story of what I could find from George Washington all the way to George W. Bush. And it ends with Bush only because I don't have a lot of other Masonic activities outside of the younger Bush. But it was really a triangulation. That's the first part, right? The first part is the narrative, then that list of all the activities, and then that triangulation, what I'm talking about, is the third part of the book, where I tell you, here are my sources. You go out and you figure it out yourself. If you don't believe me, I'll give you the source. Sure. I'll do the work for you. And so I say, if I find something that's conflicting in the comments of that third section, I'll say, well, we don't actually have the dates for this vice president, but he is claimed to be a Freemason. So I'm adding him as a courtesy, but I'm not including him in the list. But I want the brother to know who's reading it that there may be some information. I'll give him a breadcrumb, perhaps for a future generation to find that data or find that information.
For those to find out the right.
There you go. So given that my Google comment was somewhat facetious, but not completely.
Quite accurate.
The nice part I was totally true about, the lying on Google part maybe not. But so I'm assuming that one could not Google Lady Bird Johnson's diary and read the pages online. So you ended up...
There are diaries of first ladies that are there out and available online. Eleanor Roosevelt, for example, First Lady, participated in many Masonic activities. In fact, she was more active than her husband while the administration was, while the FDR was in office. Now, part of that was a function of his disability. He was unable to walk, and so in many instances, it was Eleanor Roosevelt who attended Masonic activities and ceremonies and quite regularly. There was an Easter sunrise service, which was a non-denominational religious service observance during Easter, the morning of Easter, that was held in the Arlington National Memorial Amphitheater. Roosevelt attended almost every single one of those every year, except for one or two, I think, because she was out of town. But she wanted to go. She was interested and excited and wanted to participate. And her journal confirms those records because she says, oh, I'm going to bring my assistant or my, you know, I'm bringing along so-and-so to the event. Or she'll say, you know, just came back to Washington looking forward to seeing the Masons the next day. Online. Go find it yourself. Don't think, you know, I'm not the final source. I'll give you the biography. I'll give you the bibliography. Go find it yourself.
So So what percentage of the source materials do you think was online, and how much of it did you have to go to? Like you mentioned,
yeah.
The Library of Congress.
Well, newspapers.com, and this is not I'm not getting paid by them, but newspapers.com is a very good resource for newspaper, you know, inquiry. And so you can do quickly a keyword search and go and find, you know, Mason president or Masonic president, and it'll narrow down your focus across newspapers. And I found so many activities through newspapers that were never mentioned in Masonic proceedings. Why is that the case? Because in many of those instances, they aren't happening at Masonic events. They're happening outside of the Masonic space at a social event or you know. And so why would it be covered in a proceeding? Because back then, especially in the turn of the century, into the 19th century, and especially in the 20th century, these guys did not record events that happened outside the lodge. You know, there is no record, by the way, in a Masonic proceeding, minute book, of the United States Capitol Cornerstone Ceremony. It came from a newspaper. The three lodges that participated in that event, Federal Lodge No. 1 does not have those records. Alexandria Washington 22 has those records, not covered in their minutes. Wow. And the third one, which was a lodge called Lodge No. 9 of Maryland, which is the lodge around that area, effectively died out, and we don't have any of their minutes at all. So there is no reference to Masonic, that event where George Washington participated, one of the most seminal Masonic events in American Freemasonry. We found that in a newspaper, the Alexandria Gazette newspaper across the river. Thankfully, one of their reporters was there and documented that activity.
Wow. That's fascinating. The one I'm going to mangle this. There's some Masonic event along those lines, some large Masonic
yeah.
event that I read. There was a newspaper article about it, and basically the article was what the menu was at the dinner.
Sure.
But and yeah, that was pretty much the whole article about the Masonic event.
Was, yeah.
And then they had quail.
Right, right. But you know that it's helpful, right? Because
yeah,
that's
no,
what
it's
the,
a slice of
that
life.
Exactly. It's a slice of life. That is the that was the context of the time. That was what the reporter or the editor of the paper thought. This is really important for us to know. You know, I think what happened back then is I think some of the Masons thought, well, surely someone will cover this. You know, in fact, one of my favorite there's only one. And I'm saying this is true. Literally one reference to the White House Cornerstone Ceremony. Cornerstone Ceremony of the White House occurred in 1792, a year before the Capitol Cornerstone Ceremony. For the first 100, and I want to say 175 years, we did not know what happened that day. We did not know who participated. We can assume, based on who were the officers that year. We knew that George Washington was not there because his diary confirms he was out of town. But we didn't know any of the other events. Until the White House renovation program under President Truman, when before that time, they were going out and engaging with researchers and historians. And one librarian in South Carolina finds a newspaper of a letter from a person who participated in the event, sending his thoughts on the event to his friend in South Carolina. And in the letter, it gave detailed information about who was there, where they met, you know, where they congregated to go to the White House, some individuals' names, names that we can confirm who were a part of that event. And then, like you said, slice of life, 13 or 14 Masonic toasts. Most of that letter gave you the toasts for the festive board afterwards, and you get maybe two or three paragraphs of the detailed, important information that you wish you had. How crazy is that?
Yeah. That's wild. It's amazing that people keep some of this stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Newspapers are such great resources.
It is so important to document Masonic history. We were attending the All-Masonic, Grand Masonic Day in Canada last year and Vancouver, and there was a lecture from Mary Grant Historian
on
the importance of history. And not just the lodge history, we paid these bills and we did these things, but outside events, gathering that information, trying to include it in your minutes or in some kind of historical document.
You'd think that'd be important.
You'd think so. Were there any other seminal events, things that we go, oh, I didn't know about that? Well, of course, there's probably a lot I didn't know about that.
450 at least.
Were there any
seminal.
Other unique ones that just come to mind? That
Well, are you referring to like in the White House or with presidents or just in general?
Either way,
yeah, yeah, it sort of goes. You sort of run the gamut of different activities, right?
Sure, sure.
I always found it fascinating. You know, one of these, perhaps it's like called a, like a bar trivia kind of question, right? When was the first initiation, or where was their initiation? What was the first initiation at the White House? The first initiation at the White House occurred under Andrew Johnson's administration. This is after President Lincoln was assassinated. His vice president becomes president. And there was a gentleman named Benjamin B. French. He was a past Grand Master of D.C., served as Grand Master for 7 years. Some of these guys lose their hair after 2 years. Now imagine 7 years. Yeah, so 7 years. And now this was after his term as Grand Master. And so he was working as in this, his job at the time was under Lincoln's administration as the Commissioner of Public Buildings. That meant that he was in charge of the Capitol Hill area, the buildings on Capitol Hill, the Congress, Library of Congress, all that fun stuff. And
is that the architect now?
Architect of the Capitol. That's right. Absolutely. Architect of the Capitol. He serves many of those. Actually, you know what's funny about that? Benjamin B. French, as a political move, was removed from that office. They then removed the office completely of Commissioner of Public Buildings, and then they created the Capitol, Architect of the Capitol, as political punishment for Benjamin B. French.
Interesting.
Because French supported Johnson, and Johnson, quite frankly, was not a good person, not a good president. And against the Democrat, I think he was a Democrat, excuse me. So the Republicans, well, the opposing party of Johnson basically removed that position, that position of power, and French lost his job. Well, French initiated Johnson at the White House into Freemason, excuse me, not Freemason, he was already a Freemason. He initiated him into the Scottish Rite, 4 to 32nd. The following day, I believe it's the following day or the day after, you can confirm in the book, I promise, Johnson and French get on a train and head over to Massachusetts because the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts invited Johnson to lay the cornerstone of their new Masonic building in Boston, which still is up today, by the way. That's the building that they use. And so it's this fun little, we're going to initiate you. Then the next tomorrow, we're going to all board a train, all the Knights Templar and all these Masonic groups, and we're all going to head over to Boston. And in Benjamin French's diary, they even mention like the president, you know, he had the opportunity, you know, he can sit with the governor of New York and have dinner while they were en route to Massachusetts. They could have had private residence and private dinner. But Johnson said, nope, I want to eat with the guys who are taking me aboard. And so he sat with all the Masons and had dinner with them. He broke bread with the Masons on their en route to Massachusetts. So it's one of those little interesting stories. You don't hear about those stories.
Yeah. No,
that was awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to conclude the interview so I can read the book.
Get me out of here. No.
No, I'm totally
or I can tell you, and then you can go and find that reference
to
the book. Yeah.
There you go. I don't. So, you had said earlier that you're working on a new project.
Yeah. So I'm taking the structure or the format of my first book about the White House and the Freemasons, and I'm applying it to a little unknown guy named the Marquis de Lafayette. You may have heard him. A very obscure character in history, certainly in American history.
And he's in Hamilton, isn't he?
He sure is. Yeah. Lafayette's life in Freemasonry, or his engagement, his career in Freemasonry, is really relatively unknown. We know he attended events. We know he attended activities back in France, and certainly in 1824, 1825, when he comes back to the United States. But we don't know when he was initiated into Freemasonry. There are suggestions. Authors and historians have made assumptions. They said, well, he was most likely initiated in, you know, a military lodge during the Revolutionary War. And, well, that sort of is now counteractive. That's counter to what even Lafayette is claimed to have said. Because during his 1824-1825 tour of the United States, which was like Beatlemania, everywhere he went, it was like parades and activities. And he says, I believe in Tennessee, I want to say Tennessee or Louisiana, may have been Tennessee, he basically says something to the effect of, I was initiated before I came to the United States. The problem was he never said it. It was the Grand Secretary in the proceedings saying, we had a dinner for him. here's what he said. He said something the effect of he was initiated before he came to the United States during the Revolutionary War. So it's technically secondhand. But I'll venture to guess that that was so significant that the Grand Secretary thought it really important later on to record that note in the proceedings. But yeah, so I'm cataloging every Masonic activity associated with his famous 1824-1825 tour. The best preceding guy who did this, the guy who worked on this before, guy was named by Harold V.B. Voorhees, who was a prolific Masonic researcher. I mean, puts me to shame. And he cataloged about 20 to 30 events, going through newspapers, going through everything that he can find. And so I got about 65 so far. And I'm still getting more because Grand Lodges and Lodges, now they're starting to hear about the book. They're coming to me, manuscript. They're coming to me and saying, hey, by the way, did you know that we have a sword or an apron or a tassel or a ribbon or some jewel about him visiting the lodge? And I go, I didn't even know he visited your lodge. And so that opens up another, you know, so I'm trying to get that done and published. So hopefully we'll be published just in time for the anniversary of Lafayette's arrival, which is in 2084. Excuse me, not 2084, 2024. Not 18. 1824 was the original, so it's the bicentennial. 2024. In August, he arrives in the United States. Yeah, he went to a Washington, just not your Washington.
Well, we weren't even a Washington then.
That's right.
Not even, may not have even been a territory. Well, we might have, Northwest.
I must apologize. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not a west of the Mississippi. I can't really tell you much. I only focused on Lafayette's actual tour. I'm a statistician, and I work in infectious disease by trade. My background is in infectious disease, cataloging the transmission of diseases mostly in third world countries. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Blood-based, like malaria, stuff like that. But I have a lot of time on my hands, and I'm very much interested in Freemasonry and research. I'm very much interested in research. I think we don't do a lot of it. I'm sorry. Let me clarify. That we do a lot of research, but I think new Masonic research is tough to do when you don't have primary sources. So I consider myself lucky because I'm so close. I'm in Washington, D.C. If I were in, you know, Washington State or Louisiana or California, it'd be very tough to go to, you know, Library of Congress and get all this stuff. It took me 5 years, and I'm in that area. So I can go to the Library of Congress a couple times. I can go to these presidential libraries and travel around and do these. So I can certainly understand the level of intensity it takes and the cost and the time it takes. So I don't think a lot of those people are doing these types of projects. But to me, the book is not, I'm not doing it to be the next Masonic super author, Dan Brown. You know, well, first of all, no Mason's going to be super, you know, Dan Brown. But my intention was to help people talk about history using right sources and the right information. So to me, if you open this book, my hope and my goal is that the stuff that you read is the most accurate that you can find, and the references that I give you a little bit more information and go, huh, that's interesting. Now how I see where he found that. I wonder if there's more than that. I wonder if I can find my version of that in our state. Is there a historical society that has that information? And I hope that generates some interest for people to continue Masonic research and to correct things that are wrong in my book. Oh, no. You know, there are some ideas of economic impact of fraternity is something I've always been curious about. You know, some of these like triennial sessions, Imperial Shrine sessions, they would go in the 1890s, early 20th century. Towns would effectively double in size when there's a triennial session or a biennial session. What's the economic impact of that? That's the kind of stuff I'm interested in.
Well, thank you very much. We really have enjoyed this conversation, and it's been wonderful. We'll be back to the session. We'll have some more interviews in very shortly. Well, hopefully we'll have you back on the show in the future when you finish your book, the Lafayette book. That'd be great, if you wouldn't mind.
I'm happy to do that. Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Sure. All thanks right. for having me.
Thank you.
Good luck.